Maria Studio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen Honey Masood, and Adriano Contreras. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours. It will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure.
The heavens, no man, no weapon formed against, yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtaposition in us.
Radio Lost and Found on every second and fourth Thursday from 10 to midnight, right here on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Mayor's Office considers downtown camping ban. Clark County Sheriff's Office kills third person of color in less than a year. And in international news, Brazilian congressional probe accuses President Bolsonaro of crimes against humanity. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 20th, 2021. I'm Ethan Sandweiss. ...1,887 public employees in Washington state left their jobs since Monday when Governor Jay Inslee's COVID-19 vaccination mandate went into effect. The mandate required nearly all state, healthcare, and education employees to be vaccinated by October 18th. Inslee made exceptions for certain medical and religious cases, up to 6% of total employees in terms of religious cases. He also exempted elected officials and police officers, as well as the majority of jail staff and firefighters. Washington's full vaccination rate stands at 71.4%, compared to Oregon's 62.2%. On the same day Governor Inslee's mandate took effect, Oregon's Department of Administrative Services accidentally sent out a file with vaccination status of over 40,000 state employees to the Oregonian and Salem Statesman. External Relations Director Adam Crawford accepted blame for the leak. A spokesperson for an Oregon Public Employees Union says the release violates a union contract. According to the leaked data, state police, the Department of Corrections, and the Forestry Department have among the lowest vaccination rates and highest rates of religious exemption. While Oregon cases are declining for the seventh week in a row, September was reportedly the deadliest month of the pandemic. 610 Oregonians died from COVID. 19 new deaths and 1,366 new infections were confirmed by the Oregon Health Authority yesterday. Victims range from 37 to 99 years of age. Hospitalizations have declined to 562 after a peak of nearly 1,200 in early September. Less than 5% of those hospitalized were vaccinated. Researchers at Oregon Health and Sciences University predict the state could reach herd immunity for the Delta variant by December. The White House prepares to launch a widespread vaccination effort for children ages 5 to 11, provided the vaccine gets emergency authorization from the FDA and CDC in November. The Pfizer biotech vaccine has received approval from the FDA for people ages 16 and older, and emergency authorization for kids ages 12 to 15. Recent trials show that a smaller dose for younger kids creates a, quote, robust immune response, much like it does in older people. The White House expects to get the green light from the FDA and CDC in the first week of November, and as soon as they do, they'll be sending out truckloads of the smaller doses to distribute. They plan on children being able to get vaccinated at their doctor's office, at the pharmacy, and maybe even at their school. The Pfizer vaccine has a 2-week wait period between doses, and then another 2-week waiting period after the second dose before full immunity is in effect. That means that the first kids to be vaccinated after the expected proposal could have full immunity by Christmas. The FDA also approved coronavirus booster shots from Moderna and Johnson & Johnson today, and also said that a, quote, mix-and-match approach is okay. That means that for the groups that are approved to get booster shots, they can get a different branded vaccine than their original set. A half dose of Moderna's vaccine can be taken 6 months after their original vaccination for 65 and older and at-risk groups. The J&J booster can be given to people 2 months after their original dose. The boosters are intended to increase the immunity created by the original shot, which some studies have shown to wane over time. Medical examiners in Clark County confirmed that the man killed by police on Sunday morning was 28-year-old Kafin Karuo. Karuo was a father of four. He fled a short distance during his encounter with the police and died in a neighbor's driveway where he lay for several hours. Carrillo's father died soon after hearing about his son's death. Beyond that, details of the killing are unclear. The Clark County Sheriff's Office doesn't use body cams or dashboard cameras, and no eyewitnesses have yet come forward. Police officials claim Carrillo was under investigation for first-degree assault with a handgun, although no details of that incident have been shared. Sheriffs also claim Karuo pointed a handgun at officers. Two unnamed deputies have been placed on leave. Karuo is of Micronesian descent and is the third person of color killed by Clark County Sheriff's deputies this year. Kevin Peterson Jr. was shot last October after an attempted Xanax sale while running away from the police. Genoa David was killed after a traffic stop last February for a defective taillight. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler has been holding discussions with city staff over a downtown camping ban intended to remove homeless Portlanders to so-called high-population outdoor camping zones. The proposal is popular with the Portland business lobby. Several law firms and Columbia Sportswear have threatened to move their offices away from downtown, citing theft and harassment against employees. Critics claim that the proposal contradicts Wheeler's former support for supportive housing programs and smaller-scale outdoor shelters. Among them is City Commissioner Dan Ryan, who oversees the Portland Housing Bureau and Joint Office of Homeless Services. Ryan claims that tent villages above 60 residents violate zoning ordinances and exceed the capabilities of outdoor shelter providers. In a letter to the mayor, Ryan said, quote, I earnestly want to work with you to make strides in resolving our city's most pressing crisis. However, I cannot support this approach for the reasons I've indicated. I will continue to work with you closely and in good faith to find solutions. The ban could also violate a ruling by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals prohibiting public camping bans when alternative shelters are unavailable. Nevada State Attorney General Aaron Ford and 19 colleagues from other states are joining consumer groups in criticizing proposed federal banking guidelines because they fail to condemn so-called rent-a-bank schemes. Suzanne Potter has more on the story.
20 state attorneys general, including Aaron Ford from Nevada, are slamming proposed new federal banking guidelines for not addressing what are known as rent-a-bank schemes. State attorneys general are asking federal regulators for a crackdown on non-bank lenders that partner with real banks to make loans that are sold to the non-bank partner. By using the bank's name on paperwork, the non-bank can claim the loan should not be subject to state regulations, including interest rate caps. Rebecca Borne with the Center for Responsible Lending says the federal guidance should explicitly condemn rent-a-bank arrangements.
Because the guidance is essentially silent on it, it definitely raises the question of, is it going to be read as permission for more banks to engage in these rent-a-bank schemes?
Also Tuesday, a coalition of consumer and civil rights groups sent a letter to federal regulators calling for a crackdown on rent-a-bank partnerships. In June, President Joe Biden eliminated a Trump-era true lender rule, saying it favored predatory lenders over consumers. A report from the National Consumer Law Center says in Nevada, a company called Elevate offers loans under the Rise brand with interest rates of 149% in connection with FinWise Bank or Capital Community Bank. Elevate also offers Elastic branded loans up to 109% effective APR through Republic Bank and Trust. Nevada passed a bill in 2019 limiting predatory lending practices and caps interest rates at about 40% in installment loans. Bornay says these types of loans can lead to an unending cycle of debt.
These loans are designed to be unaffordable. Lenders succeed by causing borrowers to fail. Customers pay on these loans for years often without reducing the principal.
The National Consumer Law Center also warns of a company known as Access Financial, working under the name Check and Go. It offers loans with the brand name Exact, up to 199% APR through an agreement with Capital Community Bank. For Nevada News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
23-year-old Nicholas Cruz pled guilty today to the deadliest high school shooting in American history. In 2018, Cruz killed 17 people and injured 17 others at a Parkland school with a legally purchased AR-15. Cruz apologized to his victims in court, saying, quote, "If I were to get another chance, I would do everything in my power to try and help others. I am doing this for you, and I do not care if you don't believe me. I love you." Cruz's statements confused and infuriated survivors and family members. One father called his apology ridiculous. If convicted, Cruz could face either life in prison or capital punishment. He was sentenced today for an additional 25 years for assaulting a prison guard. After Nicholas Cruz's initial arrest in 2018, investigators released details of his far-right opinions on social media. Cruz had posted statements online denigrating Black people, Jews, Muslims, immigrants, and anti-fascists. Gun magazines retrieved at the scene of the murders were carved with swastikas. Cruz also posted pictures to his personal Instagram wearing a Make America Great Again cap in support of President Donald Trump. The Parkland shooting has proven surprisingly divisive in public politics. Former Republican Congressman Jack Kingston accused student demonstrators of being bribed by Jewish philanthropist George Soros. Future Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene publicly harassed survivor Dan Hogg. The families of many survivors were bombarded with death threats from supporters of the National Rifle Association. Shortly after the murders, Florida's Republican-dominated state house rejected a ban on semi-automatic weapons by a margin of nearly 2-1. Former Trump strategist and far-right agitator Steve Bannon is being held in contempt by the January 6th committee for disobeying a subpoena related to his involvement in the Capitol attack. With more on this story and others, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Mr. Bannon stands alone in his complete defiance of our subpoena. That's not acceptable. No one in this country, no matter how wealthy or how powerful, is above the law.
The House January 6th Select Committee unanimously approved a criminal contempt report against former Trump strategist Steve Bannon for defying a subpoena. Panel Chair Congressman Benny Thompson urged other witnesses to comply. Bannon is claiming executive privilege, which both the White House and the panel reject. Republican Liz Cheney called on other members of her party to support the committee's work and said Bannon had advanced knowledge of the Capitol attack.
On January 5th, Mr. Bannon publicly professed knowledge that, quote, "All hell is going to break loose tomorrow," end quote.
The report goes to the full U.S. House for a vote, and if passed, a criminal referral would be sent to the U.S. Attorney in Washington, D.C., who could take the matter before a grand jury. After a day of meetings with Democrats, the White House says President Joe Biden is more confident about the future of his Build Back Better plan. The final bill will likely drop tuition-free community college, and while the child tax credit will be extended for another year, it will reportedly be means-tested, as requested by West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin.
I don't believe that we should turn our society into an entitlement society. I think that we should still be a compassionate, rewarding society.
Negotiations on alternative emission reduction strategies continue, with Manchin firmly opposed to government penalties on electric utilities that fail to meet clean energy goals.
The carbon tax is not on the board at all right now.
The spending plan is currently $3.5 trillion, but Biden's bottom line numbers are reportedly between $1.9 and $2.2 trillion. And after blowback from banks and Republicans, Democrats are now proposing to allow the IRS to access information about bank accounts with more than $10,000 in deposits or withdrawals in a year, instead of the $600 first proposed. President Biden's nominee to lead U.S. Customs and Border Protection was grilled by a Senate committee Tuesday. Tucson, Arizona, Police Chief Chris Magnus said he would balance border security with humane policies. On construction of a border wall, Magnus says he's met with agents who say there are gaps where a wall would make sense.
I'm not taking issue with that, but they also talk about the need for better technology, better basic resources related to their ability to communicate by radio and by phone.
Magnus, an outspoken critic of Trump's immigration policies, told senators he cares about innovation, not ideology. Nebraska Republican Congressman Jeff Fortenberry is facing a federal indictment for allegedly lying to federal officials during an investigation into contributions made by a foreign national to his reelection campaign in 2016, which are illegal. Cole Hemstreet contributed reporting. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. Divest Oregon from fossil fuels. Interview with Andrew Bogan, Communications Director for Divest Oregon. Then at 6, it's Rural Roots Rising. Tonight will be in the mid-50s with a slight chance of rain. Tomorrow's weather is in the 50s and 60s with showers in the afternoon and evening. Today in 1803, the United States ratified the Louisiana Purchase, acquiring vast portions of Central North America from the French. The quote of the day is from Family Guy. We're getting Oklahoma, Arkansas, Nebraska, Kansas, Wyoming, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Louisiana. What are the chances all those states suck? Schenectady New York Hospital, Ellis Medicine, is merging with a Catholic health system. Families worry that St. Peter's Health Partners' religious guidelines would limit treatment options for end-of-life care. Here's Emily Scott with the story.
A proposed merger between two hospital systems in upstate New York has some residents and healthcare advocates concerned about the potential loss of certain types of medical care, including end-of-life options. Albany's St. Peter's Health Partners and Ellis Medicine in Schenectady first announced their intent to merge a year ago. Ellis Medicine posted a $33 million loss last year. Because St. Peter's is owned by Catholic system Trinity Health and is governed by certain ethical and religious directives, the merger could affect care options for people facing terminal illnesses. That worries Kim Callanan of Compassion and Choices, a group that advocates for medical aid in dying.
The fundamental principle is that they should preserve life at all costs. For some people, this may not be an issue at all. It may be in line with their values and priorities. But we know a large portion of people do not want to suffer at the end of life and want to have the full breadth of options that are available.
Callanan says the merger could limit choices for families of people in the final stages of dementia or on ventilators. In a statement, the St. Peter's Health Partners system said it helps countless patients and families navigate end-of-life decisions, but did not specifically address medical aid in dying. Michelle Osterlidge is a founding member of the Schenectady Coalition for Healthcare Access, which was created as a result of the proposed health system merger. Osterlidge says the coalition has had private conversations about the merger with the health systems, but the groups haven't welcomed public talks.
Our community has supported Ellis for 100 years. Volunteers, taxpayer funds have all gone to support our community hospital, and they are obligated, frankly, to answer the questions from the public directly. They have refused to do that.
St. Peter's Health Partners says the New York State Department of Health is reviewing the management services agreement for the merger, a two-year non-binding pact that allows the two systems to start working together. It says the two companies plan to update the community and share specifics in coming weeks, pending approval of the agreement. I'm Emily Scott with New York News Connection.
In the wake of two devastating hurricanes, a nonprofit is working to expand solar energy in Puerto Rico, starting with a 10-home pilot in the city of Caguas. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on this story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When Hurricanes Irma and Maria brought damaging winds to Puerto Rico in 2017, many people struggled to survive without electricity. And even in the absence of a hurricane, the power can be unreliable in rural parts of the island. At her home in Utuado, Allison Mason has an off-grid solar system. But she says her neighbors' homes often go dark during the rainy season.
My neighbors sometimes lose all of the food they had stored in their refrigerator. Meanwhile, we don't even notice when there's a power outage.
Mason wants others to have the same peace of mind, so she's co-founded Barrio Electrico, a nonprofit that works with community groups to recruit residents who want to install solar and battery systems. Barrio Electrico and its partners oversee the financing and installation of the systems, and then lease them to residents. Mason says the leases cost roughly the same as what people pay the utility, so they're accessible to residents who cannot afford to buy solar panels. Barrio Electrico is working to prove its model with a 10-home pilot program in Caguas, and Mason plans to expand from there so more people in Puerto Rico can keep the lights on, even as the weather gets more extreme. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Senators in Brazil are accusing President Jair Bolsonaro of crimes against humanity for his response to the COVID pandemic. The Congressional Committee were previously considering charges of genocide and homicide. Brazil's opposition leader, Humberto Costa, says that the decision was made for technical, not political reasons. Formal accusations of genocide must fit certain strict guidelines. The populist far-right head of state has repeatedly dismissed the severity of the pandemic and refuses to wear a mask. His government refused to purchase vaccines when they became available, and he undercut local efforts to control the spread of the virus. Like Trump, Bolsonaro has falsely promoted the anti-malarial drug hydroxychloroquine as a supposed cure to the disease. Mass graves were dug in the city of Manaus last February, where hundreds of COVID victims suffocated to death daily while the federal government neglected to purchase needed oxygen supplies from neighboring Venezuela. So far, 600,000 Brazilians have died from the virus, a higher reported death toll than any country besides the United States. The genocide accusations stem from the disproportionately high death toll among Brazil's marginalized indigenous community. The possibility of Bolsonaro standing trial is unlikely, as Brazil's prosecutor general is the president's political ally and appointee. With a year left in his presidency, Bolsonaro's approval rating hovers around 20%. Montana is the latest of several states to legally ban the collection of other people's absentee ballots. The move is based on unfounded claims of voter fraud in the 2020 election, but it could limit the voting ability of seniors and indigenous communities. With more, here's Eric Tagadoff.
A new law in Montana, its backers said, was designed to cut down on fraud, could instead make it more difficult for some Montanans to vote. During the 2021 session, lawmakers passed a measure that prohibits the practice of collecting and delivering voters' sealed absentee ballots for monetary benefit. But Alex Raitt, legal director of the ACLU of Montana, says the law's ambiguous language could have a number of effects. For instance, on someone living in a retirement home who has a staff member deliver their ballot to the mail.
Vulnerable communities, such as seniors or people living in assisted living who need the assistance of others, are going to be particularly impacted by these types of voting restrictions.
A similar Montana law was struck down as unconstitutional in 2020. The new law is part of a wave of other Republican-sponsored bills in Montana and other states that aim to secure elections. Ballot collection is important in Montana because so much of the state is rural. Raitt says having ballots collected is especially helpful for the state's indigenous communities, where post offices and election offices may be far away. He also notes Native Americans have faced racism in the town's bordering reservations.
You can imagine that it's not on the top of somebody's list to go expose yourself to that type of racism and discrimination and hostility in order to cast your ballot.
Raitt says the law could have a chilling effect on voting because potential voters might assume the law applies to them, when in fact the restrictions are much narrower than they understand.
I think that there is a real danger that we're going to see ballots going uncounted as a result of this particular law.
Raitt says the ACLU of Montana aims to have an injunction in place by next year to prevent the ballot collection ban from going into effect before the 2022 elections. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For Big Sky Connection, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Earl Oldperson, a historically significant leader of the Blackfeet tribe, died this week at 92. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Memorial arrangements have started for Earl Oldperson, longtime chief and chairman of the Blackfeet tribe in Montana. On Tuesday, a procession on the Blackfeet Nation brought him to tribal offices where a viewing was held. Wednesday, he'll be escorted to the high school where he'll lay in state until Friday. Thursday and Friday, services are planned. Oldperson passed away last week after battling cancer. He was elected to the Blackfeet Tribal Business Council in 1952 and served for more than 60 years, serving as chairman for more than 50. In 1978, he was bestowed hereditary chief. He's being remembered for his leadership and importance to the Blackfeet people in both the U.S. and Canada. Earl Oldperson was 92 years old. Elders and young people from across Alaska are taking part in learning, sharing, and connecting on a virtual platform this week at the 38th Annual First Alaskans Institute's Elders and Youth Conference. The event features speakers, language circles, cultural sessions, and networking opportunities. This is the second year the conference is being held online due to COVID-19 health and safety concerns. Valerie Davidson is on the Board of Trustees for First Alaskans Institute and is a healthcare leader in Alaska. She urged attendees to take COVID-19 seriously, talking about its impact on the Alaska Native community, asking people to continue to take precautions, wearing masks, washing hands, and being mindful of others.
Our ancestors sacrificed everything for us, everything, because they love us so much. And we all need each other to make it. I need you. We need each other. And so, Huyana, for taking all of those extra measures to keep each other safe. The better we are, the sooner we'll be able to get through this. And as my mom says, and my grandma used to say, I'm telling you this because I care about you. I'm telling you this because I love you. Because sometimes the hard things need to be said, and sometimes the hard things need to be heard.
The state is also asking people to take precautions to help slow the spread of COVID-19 as cases in Alaska continue to be high. Meanwhile, the Alaska Federation of Natives announced its annual convention will be virtual. The AFN convention is held days after the Elders and Youth Conference. AFN says the virtual event will be held for 2 days in December due to health and safety concerns. The AFN board postponed the annual convention in October to follow COVID-19 trends. On Friday, AFN announced the virtual platform, saying current information shows continuing high rates of COVID-19 cases, hospitalizations, and deaths, particularly in Anchorage, where the convention was to be held. The Navajo Nation Council passed legislation Tuesday which prohibits the use of commercial tobacco products indoors and in public places. Health advocates have worked for years on public education on tobacco use and have been urging the tribe to approve a smoke-free bill. The Ayers Life Act was approved by a vote of 20-3. The speaker needs to certify it. The Navajo Nation president will then have 10 days to either veto or approve it. The U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs is hosting a roundtable Wednesday on economic development. Chairman of the committee, Senator Brian Schatz, will lead the discussion. Tribal leaders and Native financial experts from across the country will join federal representatives. The roundtable will focus on leveraging federal financing to invest in Native communities and economic development. Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. on Tuesday signed into law an Early Childhood Education Act. The legislation approved by the council earlier this month invests up to $40 million to replace 8 existing Head Start centers and upgrade others on the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 20th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Althea Billings. The producer is myself, Ethan Sandweiss, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Mary Sherman, Anthony Lizowitz, Antonia Gonzalez, Emily Scott, and Suzanne Potter. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. The podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ethan Sandweiss. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio, Divest Oregon from Fossil Fuels. Interview with Andrew Bogan, Communications Director for Divest Oregon.
Hey y'all, thanks for tuning in to Coast Range Radio, a radio program of the Coast Range Association. My name is Andrew. Send us an email. We want to hear from our listeners. Ask us some questions. Let us know what you think of the show. You can reach me at andrew@coastrange.org. We want to hear from you. Today, our interviewee is a human rights campaigner and policy advocate who supports nonprofits, coalitions, and communities fighting injustice. Currently, he is a senior policy advisor with Oxfam. Previously, he has held roles with Democracy International and Human Rights Watch. And that being said,